From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Bookseller Ken Sanders always rolls his eyes when I ask whether local bookstores are in trouble in the new media universe. For Ken, it's simple. People will always want to find and read a story. But when you look at what's happening, it's got to make you a little worried. It turns out for now, Ken is right. Quiet resurgence is the term used to describe the independent bookselling landscape right now. It's hard to say exactly what is working, but one reason may be the way many of us discover a new book. It's a recommendation from someone we trust. And that's the general idea for the program today. It's our annual summer book show. We've gathered some of our local booksellers to recommend titles for the vacation season. So grab a pen. We'll be back after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Well, something is going on in the local bookseller universe. For all the hand-wringing about the future in a new media landscape, things are looking good. Industry observers seem to be tempering their optimism with some caution. That's why you get terms like quiet resurgence to describe the fortunes of local booksellers these days. But many are saying we're at a tipping point. And it's hard to pinpoint what it is exactly that seems to be working. It can't hurt that the big chains like Barnes & Noble are struggling. Borders went completely under not so long ago. Some say it's PR campaigns like Local First. You can also hear independent bookstores being referred to as third places, like farmers markets. These are places that are seen to give a community its identity. But the booksellers themselves often say, look, it's about relationships. People go into a bookshop for a recommendation from someone they know and trust. And so today's show is really our version of that idea. It's our annual summer book show today. We've gathered our local experts to offer titles for your consideration as we head into the vacation season. So grab a pen and let's get started. Betsy Burton is with us. She owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Betsy, welcome back.
Thank you, Doug.
Ken Sanders, the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City, back with us again. Ken, hi.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
And Catherine Weller, the new book buyer for Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. Kat, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, so I do want to jump into the titles, but I do want to – I did find a lot of language referring to tipping points, things are looking good. Are you sensing that tipping point? Are you getting a sense that things are looking up, or have you always – I mean, you've always been optimistic, you guys, but I mean, what do you think's going on?
Doug, can we please finally put to rest the rumor that the book is dead, okay? Let's have the funeral, get it over. The book is alive and well, and so are we. Books aren't going anywhere, and people that truly love books, whether they're publishing them, writing them, selling them, or reading them, are also alive and well, and it's a really good time in the book world. It's different. I don't mean to ignore, even though I'm a Luddite, I don't mean to ignore the rapid technology and the changing in the book trade and the way information is being disseminated. But my hope is, and I see this every day in the store, young people coming in and buying books at a young age. Like I sometimes really surprise them by saying, how do you know about this book? And it kind of takes them aback a little.
Yeah.
But they're showing intelligence and maturity far beyond their years. And that, I think, bodes well for the future.
And they feel quite subversive, like they're doing something
yes.
really revolutionary to be reading books, which is quite wonderful.
Well, it is revolutionary, isn't it? It
retro
is subversive.
Chic.
It's cool
yes, we're
to
retro.
Read.
Retro. You know, the other thing I think is that the whole idea of community, not just Local First, but people love to come to events. They love to see their neighbors in bookstores. It is that third place. I think in this time of great uncertainty, which, you know, even though the economy is better, it's only better for those of great wealth, really. And I think in this time, people love to be together and have a communal experience, and it makes their lives worthwhile. So the combination of books and community is hard to beat.
Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that we still are in a time of cataclysmic shift, economically, societally, technologically. These bound pieces of wood pulp or hemp pulp, if you're lucky, they've stayed the same, relatively speaking, and they've stayed the same for a reason. It's a fantastic technology. It is an amazing technology, and they've had a hard time superseding it, really. Mm. The book is alive and well, and bookstores are alive and well. Some of us are doing great, some of us okay, some of us not so great. The truth about bookselling is it's a labor of love. Yeah. You know, we all do – we could. Every person in this room could make a lot more money doing something else, but we do it because it's an amazing thing. And the people who come into our stores get that, and they're part of what makes bookselling an amazing thing.
Great. Well, let's jump in. All right. Ken Sanders, let's start with you.
Okay, Doug. All I have to do is find my book.
All I have to do is be ready.
Yeah, well.
Heaven forbid. We gave you 10 minutes to get cracking.
But I've only been here 5. How about we talk about Michael Pollan? I know that you had him on, and thanks to Betsy here. She had a very successful event when he was in town. His new book is called Cooked by Michael Pollan. And I can't say enough good things about the writer and this book. His whole history of involvement with food, from eating it to processing it, from looking at food origins to the whole, like his previous bestseller, The Omnivore's Dilemma, just looking at the whole culture of food. He's an absolutely brilliant writer, and he really does his research. He's divided this new book into 4 sections that basically follow the 4 elements, and he begins with fire, yeah, which is close to my heart because what he's talking about is barbecue. It's something he admits in the introduction to the book that despite this lifelong obsession of his with food, he's never really given much thought to the cooking of it. Yeah. So he decided to fix that in a big way. And the barbecue chapter, even though, I mean, you know, you could write a whole book just on that, but he got the essence of it by visiting these different pit masters in radically different parts of the country. The one thing that anybody that plays around with barbecue at all will come to realize is there are no 2 people that will agree on how it's done or what it even is. It's an absolutely brilliant book, and he really makes important parallels, like getting into, well, the rise of corporate agriculture and genetically modified foods and putting pesticides in corn and all the stuff that's coming out now and the death of the family farm and people being able to buy food like we now can start doing at farmers markets. The decades since the 60s that this has been occurring parallels exactly the rise of the obesity problem in the American people. Yeah. And it's really chilling. It's a brilliant book. I highly recommend it.
Cooked. I should say also, I mean, I think I'm hearing from a lot of people who are buying it just because of the idea of making a meal for your family. And just that idea, which seems novel in some ways,
yes,
but that's what he's saying.
Like
he's
the social, a book. It's revolutionary.
Like, totally, yeah. Like, what? It's making
the social construct of the communication that occurs during meals and how we educate our children through it, too.
Cooked. Michael Pollan. That's a good one.
Then for something completely different, we have Kickstart, Memories of an Outlaw Biker by Teach, otherwise known as Ralph Elrod. He was one of the early founding members of the local Barons Motorcycle Club, and he has written a tell-it-all memoir of his life as an outlaw biker here in Utah in the West. It's a very different kind of book. He's done it all by himself, and he just wandered into the store one day. And so we're on July 3rd, when the gang is in town for the big July 4th barbecue, we're hosting Teach for a rather unusual autograph party at the store.
Wow, okay.
If you ever wanted to know why there's not a Hell's Angel chapter in Salt Lake City, this book will give you an idea.
Kickstart, Memories of an Outlaw Biker. Okay, great.
And then just quickly, even though our local favorite Scott Carrier came out with an ebook version of Prisoner of Zion some time ago, and you interviewed him on the show and he got an enormous amount of press about it, you couldn't actually get the book. But finally, a year plus later, Counterpoint Books, who also published his first book a decade ago, Running After Antelope, has finally come out with an actual non-downloadable paperback, so it's not hardcovers, but a book that you can actually read. And Scott's insights, these stories, his exploration of America after 9/11 and his stories that interweave between Mormons and Muslims are absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Prisoner of Zion, Scott Carrier, lovely guy, lovely writer. He's terrific. So, Betsy Burton.
Okay, well, because Father's Day is coming up, I've picked three mysteries which are almost guaranteed to please any father or mother, since I loved them all. The first one is Norwegian by Night by Derek Miller. This is a book that not many people know about, and it's quite brilliant. And the main character is a watchmaker. He's Jewish. He lives in New York. He was a Korean vet and actually was an assassin, a sniper. And now he's very old, and his granddaughter brings him to Norway to take care of him. And she thinks that he's senile. Well, upstairs, there's a little bit of violence going on, and tumbling down the stairs come a woman who's being abused and a young boy. And I won't tell you how this happens, but the old man and the young boy, who don't speak each other's language, end up on the run in Norway. And it's funny. It's brilliant. The father is grieving because he kind of pushed his son into going to war during Vietnam, and the son was killed. So you get the Korean War, you get the Vietnam War, you get the Balkans, you get Norway, and you get this touching story about a man who, in fact, isn't senile at all and knows how to handle himself better than most people in the world in terms of violence as well as the intellect. Norwegian by Night, not many people know about it, and it is just a stunning book.
The author again is?
Is Derek Miller.
Derek Miller.
On a very different note, but still a mystery, Carl Hiaasen. When we did a mystery edition of our Inkslinger, we got more mentions of Carl Hiaasen than anybody else, including P.G. Woodhouse.
Wow. I mean,
everybody thinks he's funny because he is very funny. Bad Monkey is about a cop who has been fired and wants to be a cop again, who finds an arm floating in the ocean and has an autopsy. There is a love story between the bad
maybe.
Cop and a married woman, the bad cop and a kinky mortician, a psycho bald bodyguard and a voodoo queen and the bad monkey, and we won't go there. And the story revolves around, of course, seedy developers. And as always, the environment is a key theme of Carl Hiaasen. Yep. Bad Monkey is hysterical, and I can't tell you how funny it is.
Set in Florida?
Well, and in the Bahamas,
in
where
the Bahamas.
Development is taking place. Yeah. So both places. And I guarantee it'll please your dad, unless he doesn't like swearing, and then stay away from it.
Okay. Bad Monkey, Carl
Bad
Hiaasen.
Bad Monkey, Carl Hiaasen. And then another mystery, Dead Lions by Mick Herron. This is the second in a series that started out in Slough House, where failed spies are put out to pasture. And in this particular one, the ED, the head of this house, is a kind of overweight, flatulent guy who everybody thinks is a joke, but actually he's a very good old spy. And when one of the old spies gets killed, he goes after him. And then other people in the house are involved in a Russian plot. And as the plot kind of winds through, these storylines begin to merge. And in the meanwhile, MI5, which gets all the glory, is sort of unable to compete with these failed spies. It's quite funny, and it's actually very well plotted and a great read, and it's called Dead Lions by Mick Herron.
Great. Catherine Weller.
All right. A lot of people think of summer reading as being really light reading. It's when you have fun, right? And God help me, I always pick up books like this. I can't quite figure it out. Daniel C. Dennett is America's greatest living philosopher and cognitive scientist, hands down. I don't usually make really bold statements like that. I tend to qualify things. But he really is. He's been around forever. He's written millions of books. He's written with many wonderful writers. Many people remember books such as, now I'm blanking on, help me, you know him. Consciousness Explained, Breaking the Spell, and Darwin's Dangerous Idea. Dennett is everywhere throughout cognitive science, which is big right now. That's what all those brain books are.
Yeah.
His book is called Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. And the whole phrase intuition pumps just turns me off. It's a weird, awkward thing. But what this book is a whole exploration of ways to think and ways to clear your blocked processes. Mm. He works on how people work through things like evolution, for instance, big questions of the day. But he starts the book with a dozen general thinking tools. Things like rhetorical questions, juicing, Sturgeon's Law, and what this excerpt is from his brief chapter on making mistakes.
Okay, here it is, an excerpt from Daniel Dennett's book, again, Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. The narrator here is Jeff Crawford.
We have all heard the forlorn refrain, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. This phrase has come to stand for the rueful reflection of an idiot, a sign of stupidity. But in fact, we should appreciate it as a pillar of wisdom. Any being, any agent who can truly say, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time, is standing on the threshold of brilliance. We human beings pride ourselves on our intelligence, and one of its hallmarks is that we can remember our previous thinking and reflect on it, on how it seemed, on why it was tempting in the first place, and then about what went wrong. I know of no evidence to suggest that any other species on the planet can actually think this thought. If they could, they would be almost as smart as we are. So when you make a mistake, you should learn to take a deep breath, grit your teeth, and then examine your own recollections of the mistake as ruthlessly and dispassionately as you can manage. It's not easy. The natural human reaction to making a mistake is embarrassment and anger. We are never angrier than when we are angry at ourselves. And you have to work hard to overcome these emotional reactions. Try to acquire the weird practice of savoring your mistakes, delighting in uncovering the strange quirks that led you astray. Then, once you have sucked out all the goodness to be gained from having made them, you can cheerfully set them behind you and go on to the next big opportunity. But that is not enough. You should actively seek out opportunities to make grand mistakes, just so you can then recover from them.
Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, his book is called Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. Man, yeah, well that, so it's not, but it's not too heavy, right? I mean,
well, no, I chose that excerpt because it really captures his writing. He is human. Despite being brilliant, he is human. He's intelligent. He's witty. He wrote this with the assistance of undergraduates who volunteered for the project. The first 13 who came into his office, he took them. So he meant it to be a book for anybody, and it really is.
I don't know, Kat. Big mistakes. I've been there, done that. And I can't say say I recommend it.
He didn't say it was painless.
Catherine Weller from Weller Book Works at Trolley Square. Ken Sanders also with us. Ken Sanders, Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. And Betsy Burton with us from the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. A list of all of the books mentioned in the programs and the ones we won't get to will be on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, it's our annual summer book show. We've invited our regular cast of experts / local booksellers to offer suggestions for the vacation summer season. Means we have three lists, long lists. We won't get to all of the titles, but we should have something here for everyone, novels and mysteries and nonfiction, even ideas for the younger readers in your life. We'll get to that as we go along. Betsy Burton with us, along with Ken Sanders and Catherine Weller. And Betsy, back to you.
Well, in keeping with Father's Day, a nonfiction title, which I said in October that I thought Far From the Tree was maybe the most important book I sold last year, and I think it's a little soon to tell, but I think this might be the most important book of this year. It's called The Unwinding, and it's by George Packer, and it really is a book everybody should read. It traces America from the 1970s through the present, right up to 2012, I almost said 1912. And it takes three people who are just Americans. They aren't famous. One is Tammy grew up in Johnston, Ohio, and worked at the Packer plant, and then a politician lobbyist, Jeff, who worked for Biden for most of his career, and one other person, John Price, who grew up in the South and left for a while but became a businessman and opened convenience stores. So these are just kind of your average Americans. And then winding through this tale of these three people, there is everybody from Newt Gingrich to Joe Biden to Oprah to Sam Walton to Raymond Carver. I mean, just all manner of Americans. But these famous Americans, for the most part, became famous because they sold people the goods. They sold them optimism. They sold them money in false ways. They did things just to build their own empires, whether they be empires of power or money. And as we wind through the years with all these people, we begin to see the corruption that occurred in America over these decades. And it's pretty chilling, you know, from bribes that are kind of under the table and private to bribes right out front at the same table. Just everything getting more and more about money, and every vacuum that was left in the middle class being filled by power, so that we're back to the robber barons, really. So the one thing that keeps the faith are the three people, none of whom are heroes. They're just people living their lives. And their stories braided with these avaricious stories give the book a real value. And I just think it's a very important book, both for the negative and the positive parts, the unwinding.
George Packer. He's on the show tomorrow, by the way.
Good choice. Another book, this fiction, and this a great read for dads. It's called The Sun. It's by Philip Mayer. And it's kind of like The Lonesome Dove in a way. Mm. It's about a family dynasty in Texas, and it's a great read like The Lonesome Dove was. But the author wrote American Rusting. He's very good at capturing the American character and what it means. And so the first person in this dynasty was captured by Apaches and raised by Apaches and lived with them until he could see that they weren't going to live much longer. Then he became a Texas Ranger, and then he became a cattleman, and he built an empire. And then his son, who had a bit of a conscience, couldn't stand the empire. He couldn't stand the lack of conscience. And so on to the third generation. And then finally, the fourth generation is a young woman who is like her great-grandfather, a power builder, this time in financial empires. So you get a wonderful tale of the American frontier, but there are also lots of passion. There are love stories. There's a great tale. So it's just a great read, but also a great picture of the American frontier. It's called The Sun by Philip Mayer. And then the third book and a novel again, is one that people don't know about, called My Father's Ghost is Climbing in the Rain by Patricio Prone. And it's about an Argentinian who's been in exile as a novelist in Europe, left his country, never looked back, and really is beginning to be a failed novelist. And his father is dying, so he flies back, and he goes into his father's study and begins to study who his father really was. And we expect this to be about the disappeared, and in a way it is, but it involves a mystery that his father was obsessed with about a murder in a small town. And what it really does, as the mystery unwinds, is talks about the generation that became the disappeared and then the generation that followed them who didn't understand anything that had happened. It's called My Father's Ghost is Climbing in the Rain. It's brilliantly written. It's part fiction, part memoir. It doesn't even know what it is, part mystery. And it's by Patricio Prone.
Great. All right. Ken Sanders.
Mae Swenson is Logan, Utah's own poet and
extraordinary poet.
Extraordinary poet. She's one of America's most widely anthologized poet. And up until recent years, though known nationally and internationally, very obscure and little known in her own native land. Yeah. Thanks largely in part to the folks at Utah State University, who's held conferences and earlier this year celebrated Mae Swenson's centennial of her birth with Garrison Keillor, who apparently knows or knew a lot about Mae Swenson.
He's a huge fan.
Did a great job of it. May has been I stumbled into her very early on through my friendship with her little kid brother, although the late Paul Swenson, who died about a year ago, was some 20 years May's junior.
Yeah.
And he, in his later years, became a poet in his own right and has published a couple of books. They're both gone now, but May's words live on, and we're going to celebrate with this new Library of America, one of the great literary series of our time and new books, has chosen to honor May. The title of May's book is called Collected Poems, and it weighs in at 759 pages. And this is not the complete poems, Doug. This is the collected poems to show you what an important force in American poetry May Swenson really is. And I'd just like to share one of my very favorite poems with all of you. The Truth is Forced by May Swenson. Not able to be honest in person, I wish to be honest in poetry. Speaking to you, eye to eye, I lie because I cannot bear to be conspicuous with the truth. Saying it, all of it, would be taking off my clothes. I would forfeit my most precious properties, distance, secrecy, privacy. I would be exposed, and I would be possessed. It would be an entire surrender to you, eye to eye. You would examine me too closely. You would handle me. All your eyes would swarm me. I'd be forever after hotly dressed in your cloying, itching, greedy bees. Whether you are one or two or many, it is the same, really. I feel as if one pair of eyes were a whole hive. So I lie, eye to eye, by leaving the core of things unvoiced, or else by offering a dummy in place of myself. One must be honest somewhere. I wish to be honest in poetry. With the written word, where I can say and cross out, and say over and say around, and say on top and say in between, and say in symbol and riddle, in double meaning, under masks of any feature, in the skins of every creature. And in my own skin, naked, I am glad indeed, I dearly crave, to become naked in poetry, to force the truth through a poem, which, when it is made, if real, not a dummy tells me, and then you, all or any, eye to eye, my whole self, the truth. 1961.
Wow. Say the name of the book, though, again. Just
Collected Poems by May Swenson, one of the newest volumes in the Library of America.
Great. Good job, Ken.
Yeah, that was great. Great reading.
Yeah, he's good at that, isn't he? Catherine.
All right. I'm just going to pull us right down here. Who Owns the Future by Jaron, and I realize I don't know how to say his last name. I'm going to say Lanier.
Yeah.
He is the author of You Are Not a Gadget, and he has returned in this time with a book, again, skewering the technology of our time, the technology that has created the digital economy. And in this book, he holds this new digital world responsible for the economic downturn and the decimation of the middle class. What he sees is a world in which ordinary people share. You share everything on Facebook. You share your thoughts on Twitter. And the elite network processors generate unprecedented fortunes from the content that you provide them for free. This, he says, is going to result ultimately in better technology, of course, while continuing to make the jobs of the middle class redundant and further shrinking the middle class and increasing unemployment. It is a passionately written book because he is a very passionate person. Of course, he has ideas for fixing this, and they are techie ones because he is, of course, one of the the pioneers of virtual reality. He comes from this industry. His ideas to fix it are very interesting, but so is the whole book. There are all these digressions into music, sci-fi themes, Aristotle's politics, spirituality, you name it. He kind of weaves it in here in a really brilliant and funky way. This book is brilliant. It's also maddening in good ways and bad ways.
Right.
And it's well worth reading at this time when we're thinking about things like what technology gives people who are in power. We are thinking about that a lot now. It's, again, called Who Owns the Future by Jaron Lanier. My next one is called To Save Everything, Click Here, and it's by Yevgeny Morozov. Another of the anti-tech techies, if you will. Neither of these guys are Luddites, but they are the voices of dissent within the technological movements. And his Yevgeny's whole thing is, can technology solve social problems? And he says, yes, perhaps. But for every beneficial use of technology, like a hydra's head, there are dozens of detrimental uses that can occur with technology, too. It's like those old maps. When he was describing this, it brought to mind the very old maps of the world that were flat. And on the edge of the world, you saw the water, and then it said, here there be monsters.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the world of tech, in a way. There's opportunity and places to journey, but here there be monsters. He maintains that a lot of the problems we're trying to apply to technology have a human base. They're human problems. They're human-generated, and thus they need human solutions, not technological solutions. Although there are places for digital solutions, and there is a place for digital technology in the world, but we're being kind of dumb in how we apply it. He writes using lots of examples, meticulous details, and it can be tempting to give this book up in the first about quarter of it, but I implore you to keep slugging through, because he really picks up steam as he goes along. And ultimately, when I was done, I thought, well, whether I agree or not, it is a valuable critique.
Yeah.
It's a well-done book in that respect. So it's called To Save Everything, Click Here by Yevgeny Morozov.
There's a theme there in those two.
Well,
what about number three?
This is kind of a theme of alienation in a way. My last book is called My First Kafka, Runaways, Rodents, and Giant Bugs. This is Kafka retold by Matthew Roth. Is this a kid's book? Is it an adult book? We put it in two sections.
Wow. It looks like a kid's book.
It does look like a kid's book. It is an illustrated retelling of three Kafka stories.
Wow.
It's the entirety of Excursion into the Mountains, an abridgment of The Metamorphosis, and an abridgment of Josephine the Singer. It's very vividly illustrated throughout with wonderful black drawings. The drawings of Gregor are just, man, he's a beautiful cockroach. What a shell. but the abridgments and the retellings are nice. They strike a nice balance for reading to children without being too dark and creepy, but still being just dark and creepy enough.
Yeah. Great. So say the name again.
My First Kafka by Matthew Roth, and it's illustrated by Rohan Daniel Eason.
Terrific. Right. Okay, so we're going to shift gears a little bit. We're going to talk about some kids' books. So for those of you who have younger readers who get bored on vacation, here are some ideas. Betsy, let's start with you.
Actually, we're not shifting gears, really.
No.
We're not. Okay, my first one is A Middle Reader by Chris Grabenstein, and it's called Escape from Mr. Limoncello's Library. And this is a book for book lovers, because Kyle is a boy who doesn't really read much, but he loves games. He's a gamer. He's obsessed with games. His big brothers are, one is a sports guru and one is a bibliophile. And so this is his area of skill. And when this fabulous new library is built, there is a contest to get in and spend the night. And of the 12 people who win, he's won. And they have a whole night to spend finding a way to get back out of the library. And it involves lots and lots of games. And, of course, the clues come out of books. And because he doesn't know a lot of about books, he has to team up with some of his fellow classmates who do. And so it's a book about teamwork, but it's mostly a book about books. And it's great fun. And anybody, and Kyle, of course, learns to like books during that night. So this is a great middle reader. Then,
wait, say the name again.
Oh, sorry. It is called Escape from Mr. Limoncello's Library.
Great.
By Chris Grabenstein. He's written a couple of mysteries. He's kind of got a funny, lippy sensibility. So then there is a book called That Is Not a Good Idea. And actually, that is the kind of chorus uttered by this little chick. And I use this in a board meeting. This is a sign I'm holding
up. Explain what you're holding up.
It's I'm holding up a sign that says, that is not a good idea.
Well, it's not just a sign. It's
it's a popsicle stick.
Yeah, right, with a chick and
with
a little
chick on top
eggshell on top.
That is not a good idea. Well, a fox is wooing a goose to come home with him and have dinner. And, of course, we all know the plot. And the chick periodically says, as they get closer and closer to his house, that is not a good idea. And at the very end, when they are actually in the house, the chick is saying, that is really, really, really not a good idea. And then the goose says, we're missing an ingredient, and pops the fox into the pot. and the chick says, I tried to warn you. It's very funny.
That's great.
That is not a good idea by Mo Willems. And then the third one is Lucky Ducklings. Oh, we're doing four, aren't we? Lucky Ducklings by Eva Moore, pictures by Nancy Carpenter. It's about a duck who took her ducklings on a walk, and she has broad webbed feet, and she forgot that her ducklings are kind of small, and they fall through the grate. And it says, and this is the ongoing chorus, oh dear, that could have been the end of the story, but it wasn't, because, and the first because is someone sees him fall, the second because is firemen come to the rescue, and the third because is when they're crossing the street, the fireman saves them yet again, and they end up happily ever after in the park. Lucky Ducklings, wonderful illustrations, perfect for very small children.
Great.
And then the fourth one, I had to have a Father's Day book, and I didn't bring it, but it's called Vader's Little Princess. And if you remember Star Wars, Darth Vader from last year, this is Vader trying mightily to parent responsibly. And it truly is. You can't go out of this house in that harem outfit. You know, that kind of parenting from this dark and grisly guy. And it's very funny, and it's actually very touching. And it's by Jeffrey Brown, Vader's Little Princess.
Great.
And Betsy, if you hadn't have told them so, they wouldn't have known you didn't have the book here.
That's true.
Let's pretend.
But we booksellers tend to be honest people, don't we? Unfortunately, sometimes.
Catherine.
All right. My first one is, again, a bit of a techie theme. Well, a very techie theme, and from a technophile, Cory Doctorow. This book is called Homeland. It's the follow-up to his previous book, Little Brother. This is a young adult novel, very dystopian, describing an American world in the not very far future. After a terrorist act has taken place on the West Coast, and society has changed, people have changed. Just after 9/11, everybody says, everything has changed now. And what's changed is the American security apparatus. To combat the American security apparatus, kids take up arms, and their arms are the technology that they understand. They use PlayStation 3s to communicate unobserved through the interwebs, the modern net. They use their cell phones. They control their own little versions of drones to help protect people at rallies. Corey is a very political person, very, very political. He's one of the contributors and founders of BoingBoing.net. He's very passionate about open access and freedom of expression. Sometimes these novels can be a bit polemic, but they are empowering, and they are important messages for young adults that you can take control, you can change things, you have that ability. And it's a ripping good read at the same time. So, Homeland by Cory Doctorow.
Great.
My next young adult novel is...
Is he related to E.L. Doctorow?
If he is, it's very, very distant.
I don't think he is.
Okay. He said once that it was like several aunts, several generations removed.
Not his kid.
No, not in any way. Yeah. second. Next one is Rhythmatist by Brandon Sanderson. Brandon is our Orem County fantasy writer extraordinaire, you know, blew onto the scene with his own Mistborn trilogy. And then when he was chosen to complete the Wheel of Time series by Robert Jordan, by Jordan's widow, he became the uber fantasy writer of that world. He's written kids' books before, the very popular Alcatraz series. This is a young adult book, and it will become a young adult series. It's about a young boy, Joel, who goes to a school to train rhythmatists, who are people who create chalk drawings, very, very complex geometric chalk drawings that are then sort of brought to life by people who are endowed with these certain gifts. Yeah. Joel can create the drawings. He's brilliant at strategy, but he cannot endow them with life. One by one, his talented classmates disappear, and Joel and his ragtag band of, you know, sort of misfits, the geeks in the geek school, right? They have to get together and figure out what's going on and how to save their isle in the United Isles of America. It's called The Rhythmatist, and it's by Brandon Sanderson. Okay. Another local author, Sarah Zarr, with another young adult book. I've talked about her before. Betsy knows her. Sarah is brilliant. She is a brilliant writer for young adults. She writes realistic fiction, which means people don't always hear about her because it's fantasy, fantasy, fantasy. But Sarah's characters, her way of bringing her characters, her young people to life in a very real way and setting them through this landscape of events is, I think, unparalleled. She is really wonderful. In this book, Lucy is a talented young pianist, gifted, and she lives in a very privileged family in San Francisco. And one day at a competition, a music competition in Europe, she decides she's not going to do that anymore. And she gets up from the stage, she walks away from the piano, and she enrages her grandfather, breaks her parents' hearts because she really could have gone somewhere with this. And she says, no, I want to go somewhere else. And it's about her, Lucy, finding out where she wants to go when not a lot of people are really rooting for her at this point, finding her own way and finding a way to love what she does, music. Love that again, and to do it again.
Lovely.
Lucy Variations by Sarah Zarr. My last one is a picture book by Anthony Brown. It's called One Gorilla, a Counting Book. Anthony Brown loves his primates, and you can tell from his illustrations, which are so vivid. Each two-page spread is just primates. So you go from one gorilla to two orangutans, up to nine colobus monkeys. They're portraits, really.
Yeah.
They're head and shoulders paintings of these collections of primates. The more you get, the more you see variations in individuality within the primates until you reach the end of the book where you find that the portrait of him. And he says, all primates, all one family, all my family. And you flip to the back where you get the wealth of humanity.
Nice.
And your family, too.
Yeah.
So it's One Gorilla by Anthony Brown.
That's terrific. Catherine Weller, the new book buyer for Weller Bookworks at the Trolley Square. Ken Sanders, the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City. And Betsy Burton owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Remember all of the books that we talk about today in the program and the ones we won't, because we won't get to them all, will be available on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. All right, we're going to move into another round here when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with our local book experts. We're talking, it's our local annual summer book show where we give ideas for titles as you head into the vacation season, and we're on to round whatever it is, four, I guess it is. Ken, let's start with you.
Let's take a literary turn, Doug. Jim Harrison, one of our favorite American authors, Michigan born and raised, has a new volume out called River Swimmers, which apparently I left at home this morning in that full disclosure syndrome of Betsy Burton. But it's Jim at his strongest form in the short novel or so-called novella, which is a word I don't really care for. But he's really, you know, a master of fiction and poetry. But I think he's very, very strongest in the short novel form. And this that book,
say the name
I'm pointing
again.
To an imaginary book.
Right.
River Swimmer River by Swimmer. Jim Harrison.
He's great.
Another one of my all-time favorite authors and people in the known universe is Wendell Berry. And Wendell's got a new collection of stories out following the Port William Fellowship, this cast of characters that he began way back in 1960 with Nathan Coulter. And all of these different clans of this fictional Port Royal, Kentucky, which is really his hometown,
yeah.
That he calls Port William membership. And again, these stories are brilliant. The very first opening story is a first-person narrative by a Southern woman. And if you want to know what the Civil War was like to ordinary people, all you have to do is read that short story. It tells you what the whole point and being of the Civil War was. And every story from the Civil War to Vietnam to contemporary events told through the Catlets and the Coulters and all the other families that are intertwined in these stories. They're just beautiful, and I think Wendell Berry at his best. And it also, it has a sense of finality about it that I don't know if there's going to be any more Port William stories coming. I can't say that. I haven't talked to Wendell about it. By the way, Tim DeChristopher will be joining Wendell Berry in a couple of weeks in Lexington, Kentucky, or Louisville, I forget which, doing a National Unitarian Church. They're the headline speakers for a conference there.
That's
great. Woody Guthrie, after all these years, has a new novel out.
What?
Previously unpublished. House of Earth, a novel by Woody Guthrie. Edited and introduced by Douglas Brinkley and Johnny Depp.
Ooh, what a comment.
I'm not going to comment on that.
Come on.
That's great.
A pair of Woody Guthries, because there's also a brilliant biography out, Woody Guthrie, American Radical by Will Kaufman, that really gets into the life and the man, not just the legend that we know and, you know, this land is your land and all of that, but really gets into him. And just really quickly, I'll just mention David Sedaris, who, if nothing else, is still writing really great titles. He has a new collection of essays, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls.
Yeah. Greatest title of the day, I have to say.
So far.
Yeah, so far. Okay, so Betsy Burton.
Okay, so for my single book, I've chosen A Delicate Truth by John le Carré. I think, as Mae Swinson's poem talks about truth, John le Carré's always written about truth. He's always tried to find the truth of the universe. He writes thrillers that are very literary novels. And this one is about England under the surveillance state. And when he wrote it, it seemed to be only about England. But now, you know, during the last week, we've discovered that it's about the U.S. as well. We all live in a surveillance state. And in this book, the U.S. and the Brits are involved in an incident in which they both are behaving very, very badly. They're doing illegal things, and it's covered up. The people who know about it are a soldier, the secretary to the minister who ran that operation from the British side, and a man who was chosen to be the person in place who knew really nothing about it. This was years ago. It's been covered up. Now it's the present, and it's beginning to come out. And what I want to say about John le Carré is that he really does portray government the way it works. And as you're about to hear in this clip, the man who was on the ground and who really didn't know what was happening and who has been complicit in the cover-up without knowing really what was covered up now decides it's time for the truth to come out. And he goes to government with full expectation that he knows his government and he knows what is going to happen. And once he does this, all will be well. And now you're about to hear what happens.
We have a new set of rules since your day for cases where sensitive issues are involved. Some already in place, others, we trust, imminent. And very unfortunately, wildlife does tick a lot of those boxes, which would mean, I'm afraid, that any inquiry would have to take place behind closed doors. Should it find against you, and should you elect to bring a suit, which would naturally be your good right, then the resultant hearing would be conducted by a hand-picked and very carefully briefed group of approved lawyers, some of whom would obviously do their best to speak for you, and others not so for you. And you, the claimant, as he or she is rather whimsically called, would, I'm afraid, be banished from the court while the government presented its case to the judge without the inconvenience of a direct challenge by you or your representatives. And, under the rules currently being discussed, the very fact that a hearing is being conducted might of itself be kept secret, as, of course, in that case, would the judgment.
John Le Carré reading, and he is a wonderful reader.
Okay, Catherine, back to you. We don't have much time left, but jump in.
Taipei by Dao Lin. Dao Lin is a young novelist. He's one of those rising stars who's held up as a writer who captures the mojo of the urban hipster. This is a paperback original novel about a young man, Paul, who moves through Brooklyn and the Taipei art and literary worlds. In this drug and internet-fueled exploration, he's experiencing, seeking what maybe you don't know, pop culture, the next thing that, you know, it's too cool to be known.
Yeah.
This is existentialist writing for this skinny jean crowd, which I don't want to be too reductive about, because he really is a talented writer, but his writing is very brief and spare and clean as that internet generation writing.
Say the title again.
Taipei by Dao Lin.
Great.
Next is Constellation of Vital Phenomena, which is a beautiful, beautiful book by Anthony Mara. He has done scholarship in both Russia and in Chechnya. This book is set in Chechnya, and it is the story of three lives who are brought together by the Chechen Wars and the total dissolution of society that occurs after those wars. Okay. There is the surgeon. There is the girl whose father is taken away, disappeared, her house burned down, and she runs away because she will be disappeared too. And the man who takes her in, a failed doctor in his own right. He takes her to the surgeon and a hospital. And it becomes an exploration of their pasts. This book slides and weaves through time as it slides and weaves through their stories. It's just lovely writing. Okay. It's dark, but it is so worth reading. Right, Constellation of Vital Phenomena by Anthony Mara.
Do this last one in 30 seconds.
Last one, Flamethrowers, Rachel Kushner. What happens when you're an artist and all you want to do is observe? Well, there really is no such thing as a passive observer, especially in the 1970s New York art scene and in Italy during the revolutions of the 70s.
Great. Say the title again.
Flamethrowers, Rachel Kushner.
Great. So we're going to have a list of all of these books that we got to, even the ones we didn't, on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. It's Catherine Weller there from Weller Bookworks. I'm going to say Weller Wookworks. Weller Bookworks, the Trolley Square. Thank you very much for being with us.
Doug.
Betsy Burton from the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Betsy, thanks.
Thanks, Doug.
And Ken Sanders, the Ken Sanders Rare Bookshop on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. Ken, thanks to you.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.